Donc cet après-midi, on commence avec une intervention de Cécile Laborde, que j'ai à peine besoin de présenter, qui est professeure à l'University College à Londres et qui a écrit de nombreux livres, en particulier sur la question du néo-républicanisme et une version tout à fait stimulante d'un républicanisme critique. Donc je lui laisse tout de suite la parole pour une conférence intitulée « What's wrong with domination ?»
Voilà. Merci beaucoup.
Ça va comme ça? Donc, je voudrais remercier Marie et Delphine de m'avoir invitée. Je suis ravie d'être parmi vous, un colloque absolument passionnant. Mon titre donc, fait référence, vous l'aurez deviné, à l'article célèbre de Taylor sur « What's wrong with negative liberty ?» Une des choses que dit Taylor dans l'article célèbre, c'est que de penser la liberté simplement comme l'absence d'interférence ne permet pas d'exprimer la valeur que nous accordons à la liberté. Donc une des choses qu'il dit, c'est qu'on ne peut pas vraiment comprendre pourquoi la liberté d'expression est plus importante que la liberté de ne pas s'arrêter au feu rouge. Et que pour comprendre la différence entre ces deux libertés, il faut une théorie substantielle des valeurs qui sous-tendent la liberté. Et c'est cette intuition de Taylor qui a donné lieu à des débats plus récents sur est-ce que la liberté c'est un concept empirique ou est-ce que c'est un concept moralisé. Et c'est ce genre de débat qui m'intéresse, et donc je me suis dit, pourquoi ne pas essayer d'appliquer ça à la domination? Donc est-ce qu'il y a le même genre de débat sur la domination? La domination apparemment c'est un concept plus moralisé que la liberté, mais qu'en est-il exactement? D'où mon titre, What's wrong with domination? Alors, j'ai essayé de traduire, je me suis arrêtée dès le titre, qu'est-ce qui ne tournera pas rond dans la domination? J'ai craint que ce soit ma traduction qui ne tourne pas rond, donc j'ai arrêté, donc je vous lis le texte tel qu'il est. Ok, so what's wrong with what's wrong or bad about domination as a social relationship? So what kind of normative concerns are we driven by when we worry about domination? So to get started, I think we need a working definition of domination. And for the purposes of this paper, I'll use a Frank Lovett definition, which is as follows. Agents are dominated when they are dependent on a social relationship in which other agents wield arbitrary power over them. So we have three conditions here, three necessary and sufficient conditions. So first you need an imbalance of power. So you need two agents, let's call them Alf and Betty. There's an imbalance of power between Alf and Betty when Alf can reliably change what Betty might otherwise want to do, but Betty cannot change what Alf might otherwise want to do. Right? So that's an imbalance of power. The second condition is a dependency on the relationship. Betty faces prohibitive exit costs if she tries to leave the social relationship she's in with Alf. It's going to be very expensive, very costly for her to leave, all kinds of costs. And thirdly, the power is arbitrary. So Alf has arbitrary power over Betty, so that it means there is no effective constraint on Alf's power over Betty. So that power is held according to his will or pleasure. That's arbitrariness for you. Okay, so that's my starting definition. So I want to ask, is domination an empirical or a moralized concept? And the second question I want to ask is, what's bad about it? And I want to separate the two questions because I think they tend to be run together. And hopefully the logic of the argument will become clear. Okay, let me start with the first answer to the question. So is it empirical or moralized? Let me start with a moralized view. So what would a moralized view look like? Okay. So here, again by analogy with debates about freedom, I start with a moralized theory of freedom, such as Ronald Dworkin's. So what's a moralized notion? It's a notion that, to define it, you need to draw on notions that are themselves moralized. Right? You cannot give a strictly empirical definition of that notion. And this is tallies with Dworkin's view that political values cannot be understood independently of one another. Right? So you can't have a theory of freedom that's independent from your theory of justice, that's independent from your theory of equality. And no interesting concept for Dworkin, no interesting political concept is susceptible to a flat empirical description. So Dawkins says negative freedom, the freedom to act as you wish without interference, doesn't capture any normative ideal. That's not a political ideal, just a fact, it's just not interesting. What he calls liberty is the moralized view, it's a normative value, and for him, liberty properly conceived involves the right you have to do what you wish with what is rightfully yours. So his concept of liberty draws on other moralized notions, such as a right and justice. So this is the sense in which liberty for Dawkins is a moralized concept. Now, I think many authors have a moralized view of domination, which is very similar to Dawkins in the structure of the definition. So James Bauman and Aris Young define domination as an undemocratic social relation. Right? So you have another moralized notion here, which is democracy. Ian Shapiro says domination is an illegitimate or illicit power. And again, illegitimacy and illicit power are themselves a moralized notion. And I'd say both definitions are strongly moralized in two ways. First, both democracy and legitimacy are broad, complex, and contested terms of political morality, right? And secondly, on that definition, the conceptual connection between them and domination is very tight. It's almost tautological, right? It's almost a definition that says domination, justice, lack of democracy, or justice, lack of legitimacy. So I don't find this view plausible nor attractive for two reasons, so two problems. The first one is, I think there's a problem with the tautology. So there is a problem with the tight definitional fit between domination and democracy or lack of democracy. Because if the fit is too tight, it makes the notion of domination redundant. Right. And that wouldn't matter if the difference between domination and lack of democracy or legitimacy was purely semantic, but I don't think it's the case. So if you look at ordinary uses of the concept of domination, it's true that when people complain about domination, they complain about forms of power that are often undemocratic or illegitimate or both. And it might also be true that domination is best combated through greater democracy. But still, I think that the definitional fit is too tight here, because when people complain of domination, they articulate a grievance that has a particular shape and form, that they point to a specific form of vulnerability and powerlessness that comes with having to live under other people's terms, under the terms of a husband or an employer or a bureaucrat. So because the strongly moralized view reduces what is bad about domination to what is bad about other things, I think it doesn't capture what is distinctive about domination as a special kind of social relationship. The second problem with the strongly moralized view is that it negates the possibility that what is distinctive about domination as a specific social relationship may actually be susceptible to an empirical matter-of-fact description. You might actually be able to give an empirical description of the relationship, regardless of the moral judgment you have about it. So, while we are going to disagree about the meanings of highly abstract concepts such as justice and legitimacy, but the scope of our disagreement is going to be considerably reduced, though not eliminated, in the case of concepts which make reference to observable and measurable facts. And domination might just be one of those concepts, right? So it looks as if domination might be more like Dawkins' empirical concept of freedom than like his normative concept of liberty. Right, so that's a suggestion. So let me now turn to what I call empirical definitions of domination. So the most elaborate, non-moralized, empirical theory of domination is actually Frank Lovitz, with which I opened this talk. So Lovat wants the three components of his definition of domination, so imbalance of power, dependency, and arbitrariness, to be susceptible to empirical description. So he wants the three components to be describable. So he uses fairly robust models of social choice, and he operationalizes the concept of power, for instance, so that imbalances of power in the real world can be measured. And he also tries to define dependency in terms of exit costs in a way that makes those costs measurable or quantifiable. Now, he doesn't say, obviously it would be insane to say that you can measure power or dependency, but he says you cannot precisely quantify and measure them, but you can quantify and measure them to some extent, so they're not a moralized notion. They do not rely on a prior evaluative judgment of what is good or bad, or right or wrong about power or dependency. They don't smuggle in a moralized view. So for him, such notions are reasonably morally neutral. More problematic is the third component, arbitrariness, right? Clearly, that's going to be the Lovat's theory stands or falls on that concept of arbitrariness, because you think to say that something is arbitrary is ipso facto to have a value judgment about it. So it cannot be a matter of fact description of the workings of a particular power. It has to be a complaint about how it falls short of what it ought to do. Lovat disagrees. So Lovat really wants to provide an empirical definition of arbitrariness, and the way he does it is through what you might call a rule of law, a procedural conception of power. So basically, a power is arbitrary if it's not subjected to regular, predictable, and enforceable rules and conventions. And so you can see that's quite plausible here to connect arbitrariness to the fairly familiar notion of the rule of law. And it's a notion of which he has a fairly extensive interpretation. So he doesn't think of the rule of law as simply applying to formal regulations and institutions, but also to any stable, reliable, and widely followed system of social conventions. So on this view, on the procedural view, a power is arbitrary if it operates without regard for established laws and social conventions. Right? So that's what he calls gaps in social conventions. And he hopes, he tries to show that gaps in social conventions can be actually measured and described empirically. Now, is this a plausible conception of arbitrariness? I don't think it is. So I think the problem with it, I think, is that the doubtful gains he makes in terms of descriptive measurability are bought at too high a price of conceptual implausibility. So I think that there are two problems. I very briefly mentioned the first one, which I don't want to go on about too much. But you may doubt whether there is anything like an objective measure of what a gap in a social convention is. So that's the first problem. But even assuming you can operationalize the notion, I think more interestingly, I just don't think that notion fits our considered judgments about domination. So consider an example of institutionalized discrimination. So consider some kind of idealized model of apartheid or southern segregation, where you have a group that is structurally discriminated against, so blacks, but they're subjected to an enforceable system of predictable rules that are substantively discriminatory, but meet procedural standards associated with the rule of law, right? So you're being treated really badly, really unfairly, but at least you know what's coming, right? So you know that if you do this, you're going to be beaten up, etc. Just imagine, well, so that's not a realistic description of the workings of the system. That's what I mean by an idealized system, there is such a thing, an idealized system of institutionalized discrimination. So the question is this domination? Well, on Lovat's definition, it isn't. right? And Love really has to bite the bullet and say the apartheid wasn't a system of domination. And I think that's really counterintuitive. So what Lovett says is, well, apartheid is really unfair. It's a system that is unjust, but it's not dominating. And I think that's counterintuitive. And the reason for this is not because discrimination itself is always dominating. Lovett thinks that for the objection to succeed, you have to show that discrimination is dominating. I don't think that's the case. I think the reason for our intuitions is that a constitutive feature of systems of institutionalized discrimination, such as apartheid or southern segregation, is that those who are discriminated against have had no role in shaping, contesting, or controlling the rules that they live under. So that's what makes the system dominating. So intuitively, we are dominated when we lack a measure of adequate control over the rules that apply to us. And the injustice of discrimination is a separate, additional wrong, but it's a separate wrong. So what are we left? What are we left with? Well, it looks as though neither a strictly empirical nor a strongly moralized conception of domination will do. So I'm going to go for a weakly moralized one, which I think is the most persuasive account. It's a weakly moralized notion. It's actually not an eccentric notion, because I think it turns out to be the best interpretation of the most influential accounts of domination, such as with Philip Pettit's recent account of alien control. I think is a weakly moralized conception, even though Philip himself says it's he denies it's moralized at all. But I don't think that's quite right. So how does a weakly moralized conception differ from a strongly moralized conception of domination? Well, first of all, the weakly moralized conception doesn't define domination as the antonym of other moral ideals, such as democracy or legitimacy. And it does provide a descriptive contouring for domination via semi-descriptive concepts, such as imbalance of power and dependency. And here, I'm quite happy to follow Lovett. But where I differ from the empirical definition of domination proposed by Lovett is that I take arbitrariness to be an inevitably moralized notion. I just don't think there is a fact of the matter about whether a power is arbitrary or non-alien. Because it seems to me incontrovertible that this so-called fact is intimately connected to moralized notions such as dignity and self-respect, control and economy, and autonomy. And these are going to be the subject of reasonable moral substantive disagreement. So we might substantively disagree about what an arbitrary power is, yet we might agree that for domination to obtain, the three conditions have to be met, so imbalance of power, dependency, and arbitrariness, but we're going to disagree as to what arbitrariness is. So this is a weakly moralized notion, because its core conceptual components do not entirely eliminate substantive moral disagreements, and I think few interesting political concepts do, but it doesn't collapse into other strongly moralized notions. Okay. So that's the first part of this. The second part is not as long, so you'll be spared. So now that we have a clear idea of what domination is, it's got that kind of three conceptual components and it's weakly moralized. And now that we know how we might go on disagreeing about whether it obtains, right? So we can disagree as to whether the power is arbitrary or not, I like now to ask the separate question, which is what's bad about it? Right? And I do think the two questions are run together too often, and I really want to separate them. So what's bad about domination? Once we know how to identify it, what's wrong about it? So again, I want to identify two ways of answering the question. So the question is about the disvalue of domination, right? Why is domination bad? What's the disvalue of domination? And I think you can have a constitutive view of this value, or you can have an instrumental view of this value, and the view I want to defend is the instrumental one, so I'll try to explain why. So let me start with a constitutive account. So this would say that domination is bad just because of the kind of beings we are. Just the kind of human beings are such that they do not like being dominated. This is quite an argument similar to one that Ian Carter made concerning the independent value of freedom. So Carter himself obviously rejects moralized conceptions of freedom, and he endorses a quantitative empirical definition of freedom as the availability of a set of possible actions. But even though he has a very flatly empirical conception of freedom, he still says we can account for the general value of freedom. We have there's a non-specific value to freedom. So I want to do the same with domination or the non-domination. And likewise, by analogy, I think there's also a rich tradition, notably of Republican thought, which insists that just being subjected to domination, to the arbitrary will of another, violates what it means to be a human being, violates basic dignity, autonomy, and self-respect. So just to be a slave is not a properly human condition, to put it differently. So we are the kind of animals, we might say, who bristle at living under the subjection of others. So I use that phrase because it's the one that Pettit uses. So I think Pettit holds something like a constitutive account of the badness of domination. Such subjection induces in us attitudes of deference, debasement, and anxiety, and these are attitudes that contravene our basic experience as human beings living in freedom with others. And this is more or less taken from Pettit. I think Pettit would be the, he should be on the slide, but he would be exemplifying what I call the constitutive account of the disvalue of domination. So domination is bad given what human beings are like. And that I think is the most common explanation for the normative disvalue of domination. But I'm not convinced by it, although I'm not entirely sure how much I'm not convinced by it yet, but let's see what you think. So I think it's both unsatisfactory and incomplete, and to try to show why, I try to think of two examples. So we're back to Alf and Betty. So Alf is a tennis player, and Betty is a child in a Victorian family, I call them. Okay. So what's Alf's situation? So Alf is joined a tennis association, and he's deeply is fallen in love with the president of that association, but that love is unrequited. So there is an imbalance of power. She doesn't love him. And he's so enamored with her that he tries to anticipate and accede to all her wishes, however whimsical or unreasonable. But all her tennis-related wishes, because they only meet within the constraints of the tennis association. It's important for my example. So he's become really emotionally dependent on this relationship. So that's Alf. Betty is a different case. So Betty is a child. She lives in a Victorian family. That is, there are no legislation protecting children, for the sake of argument. And so Betty's parents have discretionary authority over all aspects of her upbringing. In Victorian family law, children's rights are rudimentary, and they're often not enforced. So Betty is, in practice, totally dependent on her parents. Okay. Well, I want to say that both are dominated. So I want to say that both Alf and Betty are dominated. They are both within relationships which exhibit imbalance of power, dependency, and arbitrariness. But I also want to say that neither case is necessarily morally troubling on the constitutive theory that I've just canvassed. Because neither Alf nor Betty's dignity and self-respect are affected or eroded by being dominated. In fact, we might even say that they can only enjoy valuable goods insofar as they are dominated. So what are those goods? Well, in Alf's case, it would be emotional fullness, right? Being in love. And in Betty's case, she enjoys the unconditional and trusting love of her parents. So I think this means at the very least that domination can be morally trivial in Alf's case, or it can even be valuable in Betty's case. And there probably are more important interpersonal values than non-domination. So on this ground, I don't think we can say that domination is constitutively bad. But I want to say that it's often instrumentally bad. So that's how I justify my move here, because we have good reasons to worry even about valuable forms of domination, such as that of Betty. Alf, we don't worry too much about Alf, right? He's an adult, and he's only dominating in a very specific context, the context of the tennis association, the voluntary association, presumably he can leave. And he's only dominating the activities that relate to the association. So he's not Betty's slave. So assuming Betty is now the president of the association, sorry. So he's not the president's slave. By contrast, the scope of Betty's domination, the child's domination, is much greater and much more morally significant. Right? Because as a child, she's dependent on those who dominate her for the fulfillment of her most basic interests. Interest in nutrition, health, and education, most notably. Right? So this gives us a powerful instrumental reasons, I think, for worrying about domination, even if domination is in other ways valuable. So domination is empirically associated with the denial or violation of people's basic interests, and hence the connection between domination and the instrumental protection or lack thereof of basic interests. Domination makes exploitation, abuse, neglect, and discrimination accessible, pervasive, and unpunished. For those reasons, we have to worry about domination, but not because domination itself is constitutively bad, because it's instrumentally bad. Because Betty's parents have the power profoundly to affect the life prospects of their dependent in an arbitrary way. So that's how we can justify measures such as, in Victorian context, compulsory state education, the prohibition of child labour, protections against child abuse. All of that is about reducing the arbitrariness of parental rule. Right. But you still have to say that, to some extent, parents' rule has to be arbitrary. You have to give discretion to parents to raise their children, because that's what it means to be in a loving relationship with others. So in this scenario, the state would regulate private relationships of domination insofar as those relationships have the potential to endanger and violate people's basic interests. So that's how I would connect domination and basic interests. Too often the connection is made in a loose way. So Pettit, in his early writings, says domination is bad because he fails to track basic interests. I don't think that's the definition of domination. I think we need an independent way of defining domination, and then we need a separate story of what is bad about it. And when Philip says domination just fails to track interests, I think he confuses defining domination and explaining what's bad about it. And that's, I've tried to disentangle the two questions. So what if anything can be said in favour of this account? Well, first of all, he provides us with a criterion for discriminating between Alf and Betty's situations, so between more or less problematic forms of domination. So both are dominated, but we don't worry about Alf, but we worry a lot about Betty. And so this, if you go down the instrumental route, seems to me it allows you to clearly distinguish what domination is from what is bad about it, and it further distinguishes between the constitutive and the instrumental disvalue of domination. So while domination is often bad in itself, as Republicans have long argued, it becomes a suitable object of political concern only insofar as, and to the extent that it does affect people's basic interests. And I'll stop here.
Merci.
Les questions.
Thank you for too much of the paper. I have just one remark, which is not so substantial. Why do people think it seems is the case with Lovett that moralized things are not empirically measurable? Because it's not true. You can have anything and say this is good or bad, this is the criteria, and I can measure.
Okay, so what you mean by measure is you can provide an ordering of things that are more or less bad. That's what you mean by measuring. I think their view of measurement is different. I think their view of measurement is something you can measure is something you're less likely to disagree about. So it's more about offering something that looks more like a social scientific account, something that looks like a fact, as opposed to something that people will reasonably disagree about. So I think it's not so much about measuring as in disagreeing about the ranking of certain state of affairs. It's about discriminating between state of affairs that are empirical state of affairs, that a social scientific approach can actually get facts about, and other facts which are purely moral facts. And that's what they're trying to do, I think, to have a kind of blue water between things that can be measured scientifically and things that can only be the object of a moral disagreement.
I'm wondering if it's not a wrong conception of
I agree
social
with that,
scientists, because they are contesting each other. You know, people are not, or things are not entering easily in a category, so everything is...
No, I agree. I mean, I think it's a brave but ultimately unsuccessful attempt, yes. And I agree with you. And that's why I would go for not the fully moralized view, which I think has its problems, but I think something like a weakly moralized view has to be the right one. The claim is not that all our notions will be of that kind, right? So it might be that things like justice are going to be fully moralized through and through. That is, it might be the case that there is no fact about justice that we could all agree exists. Whereas I think with domination, I kind of agree with Lovett that there are probably facts about domination that we can agree upon. Imbalance of power, you can probably measure that. Exit cost, you might be able to agree that it obtains factually in the real world, but I think you're always going to disagree as to whether the power is arbitrary. And this is what matters. When you talk about domination, what matters is whether the power is arbitrary, right? So that's why I want to say it's weakly moralized, because two components out of the three, we can actually agree on the fact of domination. These people are dominated. Yeah, you can see they're dominated. Whereas I think things like justice or freedom or equality, these are probably going to be fully moralized through and through. We're not going to be able to agree even on a fact of the matter about it. And then, you know, my theory doesn't exclude the possibility that there is a spectrum of, at the other end of the spectrum, there are notions that will be just purely empirical. So you can probably provide a definition of what a parliament is. There are also political notions that lend themselves to more empirical descriptions, even if we're going to disagree about whether particular instances fit the definition, but we're still going to start from the same factual basis.
Constance?
Oh, merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. That was really fascinating. And one move I'm specifically fascinated by, that you move basically to the instrumental paths of domination.
Yeah.
But one question I have there is, if you judge the instrumental paths of domination in terms of the people's own interest, how do you get to the people's own interest, given that certain kind of domination is exactly the change, how to say, the change of the dominator of the person's own interests, making them believe that, how do you get there?
Yeah, I mean, I've written about this elsewhere. So the question about whether you can have a purely subjective or a semi-objective view of basic interests. I agree with you that you don't want to be in a position where people are so dominated that they lose a sense of what their interests are. So to some extent, you're gonna have to go down a line that doesn't completely replicate what people think are in the interest of, because you have to account for adaptive preferences and false consciousness and so forth. But you don't want to go the other line either, so you don't want to go into a purely objectivist view of basic interest. So that's where there are various accounts that allow you to do this, and that's where I would go down the line of more political models of democratic decision making, etc. But I don't think that, I see that as a separate problem in a sense to the structure of this paper, because in relation to what I try to do in the paper is to show that many people in the literature, including Pettit himself, want to define domination in relation to the violation of basic interests. And intuitively, I think that's wrong. That's really confusing what domination is from what is bad about it, right? And I think that holds regardless of the theory of interest you hold, if you see what I mean. That's quite independent. Whichever theory of interest you hold, I think that problem is still there. That's what I'm hoping anyway, but I need to think about it.
Marlène, et puis après, c'est la même question, je vais poser la même.
Mais, moi aussi, ma question a été liée. Je me demandais si on ne pouvait pas reformuler ce qu'il y a de mauvais dans la domination en termes instrumentaux, en termes constitutifs. Si on dit, si la domination est mauvaise parce qu'elle contribue à l'autonomie des agents, ouais. Si on dit l'autonomie, c'est pouvoir former ses propres. Dire, est-ce que finalement, si on ne peut pas, les deux thèses en fait, se reviennent aux mêmes, si on insiste en particulier sur ce point-là, peut-être moins sur la notion de dignité qui est peut-être encore plus moralisée que substantielle, montrer qu'il y a des usages très, très normatifs, mais pour l'idée d'autonomie, j'ai l'impression.
Tout à fait. Et c'est pour ça que je ne veux pas exclure défendre une théorie instrumentale n'exclut pas certains aspects de la théorie constitutive. C'est-à-dire, je ne dis pas que c'est l'un ou l'autre. Et précisément pour la raison que tu suggères, c'est-à-dire que un des intérêts que la domination met à mal, c'est l'autonomie.
Oui.
Clairement. Et est-ce qu'elle la met à mal de manière constitutive ou de manière instrumentale? Sûrement de manière constitutive. Alors, et c'est la définition de l'autonomie. Un des problèmes de la dependency. Quand les exit costs sont très, très 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 élevés, par définition, ça met à mal l'autonomie de la personne qui est dominée. Donc c'est vraiment intrinsèque, c'est constitutif à la domination qu'elle viole l'autonomie. Donc je suis parfaitement conscient du problème. Une façon dont je voudrais le résoudre, c'est de dire, tout comme je ne pense pas que la domination soit toujours mauvaise, je ne pense pas non plus que la perte d'autonomie soit toujours mauvaise. Donc je veux maintenir la distinction entre les deux en disant qu'il y a des cas où la perte d'autonomie est une violation d'intérêt de base, mais pas dans tous les cas. Donc l'intérêt de la personne qui est amoureuse, c'est évident qu'elle a perdu une partie de son autonomie, mais on ne considère pas que c'est un basic interest dont elle a été injustement deprived, qu'elle a perdu de manière injuste. Donc je pense que j'appliquerai le même raisonnement. C'est-à-dire de dire que tout comme je ne pense pas que la domination est toujours mauvaise, de la même façon, je ne pense pas que la perte d'autonomie soit toujours mauvaise. Et ce n'est que dans certaines conditions que la perte d'autonomie sera une violation de l'intérêt de base.
Alors, il y avait une question de Christian.
C'est la même,
c'était la même.
Exactement.
François, et puis monsieur. Et après, on s'arrête.
Merci, Cécile, pour la présentation. J'ai beaucoup apprécié l'espèce de parallèle avec la valeur constitutive et instrumentale, tout ça, mais ça suscite chez moi des questions. Et je me demandais dans quelle mesure on peut pousser le parallèle, parce que pour Carter, ce qu'il essaie de montrer, c'est qu'il y a une valeur propre à la liberté globale, par-delà la liberté spécifique. Et je me demandais si on pouvait faire la même analogie et distinguer une domination spécifique et une domination globale. Et donc, j'ai l'impression que les républicains, ils s'intéressent à la liberté comme non-domination dans un sens global. Mais si on a une définition de la domination qui est même weakly moralized, là, on est vulnérable, du moins, à la critique de, oui, mais si votre définition de la domination elle est weakly moralized, alors la valeur, de, le overall freedom as non-domination est réductible à la valeur de certaines libertés spécifiques comme non-domination.
Ouais. Dans l'ensemble, je suis plutôt... Je suis plutôt rose là-dessus, c'est-à-dire je pense qu'au lieu de mesurer la liberté globale, hein, il vaut mieux mesurer des libertés spécifiques.
D'accord.
Alors dans la phraseologie de Petit, c'est la liberté des actions et non la liberté de l'agent. Et Petit distingue entre les deux. Alors évidemment, les républicains disent aussi qu'il y a une liberté globale, qu'il y a la liberté de citoyen. Le citoyen est non dominé, mais je ne pense pas que la non-nomination du citoyen, c'est la somme des libertés spécifiques qu'il a. Donc d'accord. Je pense que ça va être une théorie différente qui va s'appliquer à la théorie de la non-domination globale, ça va être une théorie de la citoyenneté. Donc on peut parler à la fois d'une personne non-dominée et d'actions qui sont non-dominées.
Donc dans ce cas-là, il n'y aurait pas une disvalue générale de la domination, mais une disvalue spécifique de certaines formes de domination dans certains contextes. Et,
oui.
Et c'est de ces formes de domination qu'il faut se protéger en fait.
Et il me semble que dans l'exemple de l'enfant dans la famille et oui. du joueur de tennis, enfin, tend à aller dans ce sens-là.
Ouais, ouais.
On peut désagréger différents types de problèmes. Mais je suis assez sceptique par rapport à la mesure de la liberté globale.
Oui. Ça marche, merci.
Alors, une dernière question.
Donc, oui, en fait, je me demandais avec la remarque qui avait été faite ici, si. Dans la conception instrumentale, il peut avoir une forme de compatibilité avec la vision constitutive. Est-ce qu'on ne pourrait pas, du même coup, dire que dans les cas où il n'y a pas d'abus au niveau de la violation des intérêts de base, dans ce cas, il y aurait une forme de potentialité de domination qui n'est pas actualisée, qui ferait que, du même coup, par exemple, dans le cas de la joueuse de tennis qui tombe amoureuse, il y a pas vraiment...
C'est un garçon, en fait.
Il n'y aurait pas de sens fort du terme, notamment à cause du pouvoir arbitraire, qui n'est pas pouvoir arbitraire parce qu'il réside une forme d'autonomie, parce qu'elle est plus grande dans une relation.
J'ai raté la dernière part de votre commentaire.
Ça veut dire que dans le premier cas, en haut, le joueur de tennis, il n'y aurait pas justement de forme de domination au sens fort du terme, parce qu'il reste une forme d'autonomie, il n'y a pas une forme d'assujettissement, un pouvoir arbitraire, au même titre que l'enfant dans la famille victorienne. Et si, justement, les deux visions ne sont pas opposées, mais se complètent mutuellement d'une certaine manière, alors là, on ne pourrait pas distinguer de manière aussi forte le fait que, d'un côté, on arrive avec une conception précise de ce qu'est la domination, et ensuite, on va dire pourquoi c'est quelque chose de mauvais. La domination serait toujours et déjà une forme, justement, qui serait condamnable parce qu'elle impliquerait de facto le fait qu'il y a une perte d'autonomie, une forme d'assujettissement, et qui peut mener directement à une forme d'abus des intérêts de base. Donc, dans ce cas, je me demande, j'essaie de rapprocher les deux, parce que je crois que la conception moralement faible implique déjà des présupposés moraux, donc implique une condamnation systématique des formes de domination. Il faudrait distinguer avec la proposition que vous amenez, c'est bien, parce qu'on peut avoir différents degrés de domination. Ce qui est bien à voir, il faut avoir une conception précise, mais du même coup, j'ai l'impression que c'est des questions qui sont reliées, qu'on ne peut pas distinguer de manière aussi forte au niveau conceptuel. La domination serait toujours mauvaise, parce qu'elle impliquerait une perte de l'autonomie, donc une forme d'abus des intérêts fondamentaux dans tous les cas.
En fait, je me pose des questions sur l'exemple de l'enfant, en fait. Parce que pour des raisons qui, je crois, coïncident avec celles que vous suggérez, c'est que dans la définition de la domination, je dis que pour qu'il y ait une domination, il faut que le pouvoir soit arbitraire. Mais c'est cette notion qui va être sujette à reasonable disagreement. Alors, dans la famille, qu'en est-il? Et là, il y a deux questions qui se posent. La première question qui se pose, c'est l'enfant, par définition, n'est pas autonome. Donc, est-ce que ça fait sens de dire qu'un enfant est dominé? C'est le premier problème. Deuxième problème, est-ce que c'est vraiment un pouvoir arbitraire ou est-ce que c'est simplement une discrétion? Et là, c'est une redéfinition du pouvoir parental en termes non moralisés, La discrétion, c'est flat, c'est un terme empirique. Et donc, on dit, on donne aux parents non pas un pouvoir arbitraire de dominer leurs enfants, mais on leur donne une discrétion de décider ce qui est bon pour eux. Donc, c'est un peu les deux points aveugles de mon papier pour l'instant. Merci de m'avoir donné l'occasion de les exposer. Merci.
Merci beaucoup.